Good afternoon. It is Monday, the 30th of August 2016, just about 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Brian Gerrish, with me in the studio, Mike Robinson. And we are joined by a live video Skype link by Alex Thompson with Eastern Approaches. Alex will be reporting from the Netherlands. Well, the sun is shining. That's all we need to say. Reports are from across England and Wales, and also from Scotland, so that's got to be good. Well, let's just have a little look at what the BBC's got to say, and we're very intrigued that the BBC is basically providing a free advert for the Janner family, because we've got the son, Daniel Janner QC, who is saying he thinks that the child abuse inquiry is going to be desperately unfair to his late father, and it should be really postponed until this can be sorted out. But the meat of the report is that accusations against Janner were unfounded, unfair, unreasonable, and the Janner family want the opportunity to question deeply anybody who's come forward to make accusations against Janner himself. If you're still curious as to which side the BBC is on, here is part of that. The CSA inquiry will not offer the Janner family an opportunity to fully cross-examine those who accuse Lord Janner. So this is the law, Mike. Apparently, if you get to the upper echelons, you get the exclusive right to question people. But of course, no mention of the victims, no mention of child abuse whistleblowers who are still in prison. The BBC is simply flat out to preserve the great and the good. And if that's one side of the corporation, this one's got to be the other side. Just an astonishing quote by Mr. Paxman, who said that pensioners are virtual corpses riddled with incontinence and idiocy. So he's 66, but he made this remark after reading a magazine which was designed for more mature people, and this is his comment. So it gives you a little clue, I think, into the sort of mindset of the great paid people for the BBC. Mm. But you've also got information on who's looking after our health.
Well, before we get onto that, we should probably just say it is actually Tuesday.
It is Tuesday. Well corrected. I said Monday. Yes. Any apologies for that? Obviously, we had a long weekend.
Yeah. Okay, this is Dame Fiona Caldicott then. She is apparently the National Data Guardian, and she is encouraging people to get involved in a consultation about the way that data is used, NHS data is used, data security and the consent/opt-out model. So 7 weeks ago or so, she published proposals, which are, she says, strengthen security around health and care information that is shared with third parties. And she is asking for people to get involved in a consultation over that. The proposals, well, among other things, they've suggested that people should be able to opt out for personal confidential data being used beyond their own direct care. They also recommend that the consent opt-out model is put to consultation. And she's saying, when I published my review in July, I was very encouraged to see the level of interest. I was also pleased that a wide range of organisations and individuals welcomed the review, including members of the public, researchers, clinicians, service planners and others. And she's saying there's currently a consultation taking place on the proposals, and I hope that as many people as possible take this opportunity to have their say. Well, basically, they're pushing through with various data sharing initiatives with NHS health-related data. If you don't get involved in the discussion, of course, your silence is taken to be agreement. So perhaps it would be wise to get a copy of the consultation and fill in the form and let your feelings be known.
Right.
That's it.
That's it.
Moving on. This is an interesting little blog post on the London School of Economics website. Why sticking with Labour is likely to be the Cooperative Party's quickest route back to power. Now, many people don't know that the Cooperative Party even exists, Brian, because, of course, it's hidden in the background. And what this article is saying is Jeremy Corbyn's probable romp to victory over Owen Smith in the latest Labour Party leadership election has raised the spectre of the party splitting in two. This scenario would see moderates, with most of the parliamentary Labour Party going one way, and socialists, with much of the membership, going the other. But Labour, still scarred with the memory of the 1980s and the breakaway Social Democratic Party, are understandably reticent to countenance splitting the main opposition party in two, a move that would likely further entrench Conservative dominance. Perhaps that's the plan. Anyway, they go on to say, however, some have mooted that Labour's discontents need not form a new party, but instead reinvent an old one, which does have deep roots in the working class. The Cooperative Party now, what many people don't realise is that the Cooperative Party, many Labour Party members are also members of the Cooperative Party. So they're suggesting that the plan would be to rename for the Cooperative Party to rename itself the Cooperative and Labour Party. And away they go on. Well, now the Cooperative Party, of course, part of the cooperative movement. Most people think of the co-op in terms of the food stamps and the bank, perhaps, which is supposed to be ethical. But in fact, it is a whole political movement which has, what, communist roots, perhaps?
Yes, is the answer.
Right. Okay, so perhaps it should come as no surprise then that since 2012, which was the year of cooperatives, we're seeing an increasing moves to convert local authorities, local councils, into cooperatives, and in fact many, many other public bodies into cooperatives, the public sector being mutualised hand over fist at the moment, of course, we must mention again the Behavioural Insights team, which itself has been turned into a mutual. So this Cooperative Councils Innovation Network, a common purpose-y type network, designed to encourage various councils to become cooperatives, and that is an ongoing agenda, which again changes the constitutional situation and changes the relationship between the individual and the state. And it's happening all behind the scenes and quite dangerous, actually.
And this is also big society agenda.
Absolutely, yes.
So the government has consistently said, oh, well, we are pushing power down, we're giving power down to the lowest levels, but in fact what is actually going on is control from the highest levels, and you're breaking apart the structure which protects society, and in is coming this new structure. So this is big society, but interesting to see the cooperative movement coming to the fore. And I'd just say, for those of you who think that the cooperative movement is about the best prices and a good selection of food for older people, of course, if you get into it, you'll see that it's absolutely big business. Everything from selling through large stores to massive property development. So it's a very commercial organisation.
Alex, what's your view on the cooperative movement then?
Well, for a long time we were told in Britain that it was something unique to us, that we had this heritage of the nonconformist churches and the people in the shires of England scrimping and saving and setting up these cooperative societies and the link with the mutuals, the building societies, and it went into America. Since moving to the continent, I've realised that they've had real cooperatives over here. The Dutch bank that I bank with, which until very recently was the only AAA rated bank available for retail banking, where you could deposit your money as a private individual. Rabobank started as a farmer's cooperative in that sense. What has happened, as with so much else of where the British and the English-speaking nations were in the lead, is we went to sleep and we were told that we still had the substance of what the title said. We were told we had cooperatives. And what better way to slip in what you were talking about, Marxism, Fabianism and communitarianism, than to do it under this label of something that the British people already trust and think is still in their own hands. The Co-op Bank, by the way, had a huge number of scandals in recent years. I think over the mis-selling of insurance and interest rate scandals and all kinds of things that you might know more about than me. But the whole movement, like with the Fabians, which is another elite movement within Labour, is there to ride off the backs of the working man. So the Labour Party, with its double-barreled name, Labour and Cooperative, is against the labourers and non-cooperative. And in the same way, the Conservative and Unionist Party, and we'll see that in a slide in a moment, is neither conservative nor unionist. It's more cultural Marxist and federalist. So the parties we're voting for do the opposite of what they promised to do.
Absolutely. And of course, at the heart of this is the constitutional reform agenda. So we were talking about Corbyn's comments about the House of Lords last week, and now we've got Gordon Brown getting involved. So this next set of slides, Alex, all seems to be referencing a speech he gave at the Edinburgh Festival. Is that correct?
That's correct. And I used to think that the Edinburgh Festival and others of its ilk were just August silly season stuff. But no, living in Cheltenham for a few years, I realised that the literary festival there was used to fly kites, and serious political and public life people were there, whether they were grandees or retired people, or whether they were still in the running. They were there really to tell the establishment which way things were going to move in the next few years. So the Edinburgh Festival, in this case the literary arm of it, is a serious venue for Brown to have said this.
Right, so this article saying that Brown wants the House of Lords abolished, and the article says, while Brown has been edging towards this pro-federal stance for months, having resisted it for much of his political career, his allies in Labour insist this more radical viewpoint is driven by the crisis forced on the UK by the unexpected vote in June to leave the EU. It is, Alex, absolutely incredible to me how many things that are going on at the moment are all happening because of Brexit.
Yes, it's very convenient, isn't it? I mean, if you follow Scottish politics, I don't want to steal David Scott's thunder here, but if you follow the hotheads of the SNP on Twitter, you will see that they are in stitches at the falling apart of Scottish Labour, which has only one Westminster seat left and very few in Holyrood compared with what Donald Dewar and the founders of the Scottish Parliament were envisioning. They wanted it to be a Labour fiefdom. So what has Brown and these other grandees done? A bit like Rifkin from the Tory side, who's lost his power base in Scotland. He's really trying to go with the flow of the Federalist and break down the UK agenda and repackage it as though it were the only way to save the Union. We've been talking about this before, save the Union by destroying it. Who would have thought that Gordon Brown, this ultimately, pure establishment figure, would have been saying we need to abolish the Lords and have an elected Senate. This was absolutely not his position or that of his political class in the Central Belt of Scotland. There's been pressure exerted on him, the pressure of events and possibly personal pressure as well. I mean, the other angles of what UK column covers indicate that there are many vulnerabilities that Brown and his ilk are subject to.
So this is followed up then with this article from the Italian press, basically saying we've seen it all before. Why on earth is Brown calling for a Senate in the United Kingdom when our Senate in Italy is one of the most corrupt, nasty little organisations in the country?
Well, yes. For those who are not aware of how other constitutions besides ours arrange second chambers, this isn't just the Continentals. Even common law countries, the United States, Australia, what they do is they say we don't want an elected second chamber, which is simply a repeat of the first chamber. So we don't just have geographical constituencies or proportional representation for parties. No, in the second chamber, where there is one, and by the way, some countries do without, like New Zealand and certain, and one US state, Nebraska, but where they have one at a federal level, what they do is they say, well, we must balance the popular representation of the lower house with another kind of representation in the upper house. So the US Senate until the 1930s didn't even have a directly elected senators. It had state appointees, and that's a fair balance. That's a bit equivalent to our peerage of the land, you know, so that other kinds of interests are represented. But the Italians have gone for, obviously, the Napoleonic model. That's the only possible thing that would replace the Lords in Britain, because we wouldn't look to our own common law heritage overseas. We would look to the EU with its Napoleonic model. And so we would go the way of the Italians of saying, right, the mayors of city regions, the provincial governors are going to have de facto ex officio seats in the Senate. So it's going to be what the Americans would call a pork barrel.
Yeah. Yes. I'll just add, of course, this fits in with that statement by Tony Blair back in 2000, I think it was, with IPPR, where he said in the future there will be appointed, everybody will be in appointed positions. So, obviously, this has been planned for many years.
And a key point here, Alex, is at least this is my point anyway. You know, the House of Lords comes under a lot of criticism for being undemocratic because Lords are appointed. But the point is, if we replace this so-called undemocratic appointed chamber which is there as a check on the House of Commons. What we end up with is no check on the House of Commons, because we end up with an elected second chamber, which will again be based on the party model, quite possibly, because all local authorities, even if we choose mayors and local officials, they these days belong to one party or another. And the next thing, we have a whipped upper chamber alongside a whipped lower chamber, and that becomes a very untenable situation from a democratic point of view, does it not?
It does, and we've been here 2,000 years ago. The Greeks had only popular assemblies, and so they had a, you know, perish the thought, but they really did have a simplistic view of democracy and were easily manipulated by demagogues. The Romans learned from that and had a Senate which checked the ambitions of people who were wanting whipped party systems, which the Romans effectively had in embryonic form, you know, and that's what the Lords did in its pre-1999 lawful model. A Lord would stand up and say, "My Lords, in 1,000 years of my family's history in this place, I've never seen such folly." And he would be able to speak over the heads of the whipped party leaders to the people and tell them really what was good for them in the best sense of the word, in a patrician way. The pre-Roosevelt US Senate was the same. The senators from Montana or wherever would say, "Well, okay, the two parties have got a majority in the lower house of Congress and the House of Representatives, and they want this, but it's not in the interest of my state, and I won't have it." And so you have to entrust elder statesmen with a constitutional knowledge and a historical continuity, with spotting things that parties and their whipped-up followers are not going to see or are going to deliberately cover up.
Indeed, and as I've said many times, the House of Lords is the only body which is preventing the House of Commons from pushing through, without any sort of by your leave, quite a lot of legislation at the moment, so they serve a useful purpose. But anyway, getting back to Brown's Edinburgh Festival speech here, he's then talking about Scotland needing home rule, so he wants to break up the union. This is absolutely at the centre of the constitutional reform agenda at the moment, to break up the union, to devolve power, ultimately to get rid of Parliament. But he's saying a new UK agreement would allow Scotland to sign up to agreements with international bodies where Holyrood's responsibilities are affected should be looked at. I favour a People's Constitutional Convention for the UK. Now, in theory, this might be reasonable, but with the level of constitutional knowledge that the general public has at the moment, that may not be the best approach. This is clearly why he's calling for it, of course.
Well, absolutely. A constitutional convention is a valid thing coming from Germanic common law, and you see it in many parts of our history and in the British Isles, the Isle of Man, Iceland, the oldest parliaments. They realised that as well as their elected representatives, they needed the people to come together once every while to review their constitution. Fair enough. But as we've discussed last year and before that on UK column, I think in 2014 actually, a constitutional convention would have this third sector stuffing it as well. Interested stakeholders and parties and organisations would be involved. By the way, we're not the first to have our common law upper house nobbled. The Irish government tried to abolish Seanad Éireann, the upper house of the Oireachtas, the Irish Parliament, in 2013. And a wonderful independent senator, who is actually, by the way, corresponding with us very positively on the Doherty case now, a senator called David Norris, one of the several independent men who they have in both houses of the Dáil, stood up and ripped into Endicenny for 15 minutes. See it on YouTube if you look up David Norris, Endicenny 2013, about the dissolution of the Senate. And it was prevented by one brave senator who was not in hock to any party, and Brown and his ilk do not want to see that happen again.
And we follow that on with this one, the view from the EU. This is former British Prime Minister Gordon Brown on Monday called for a major overhaul of the constitutional structures, suggesting taking powers currently held by the European Union and giving them to the Scottish Parliament in Edinburgh. So this is just further break up of the Union.
I thought this was very telling. Politico.eu is obviously the EU hacks side of things, and they're going to put things a bit more honestly than our own press do. None of our own press would say anything as direct as, okay, we're leaving the EU, let's put the EU power straight into Holyrood, in the case of Scotland. And although he's not saying it, the same would be true of Wales, Northern Ireland, London, and perhaps in time the English so-called regions. But the European Union House magazine, as it were, Politico.eu, is saying it. And it shows how the European Union understands that even if it's not formally in control of the UK in a couple of years' time, its continuation model will be the regional and national assemblies.
And you mentioned earlier on the situation with the Conservative Party and its view of itself at the moment, not quite as we may view it. This is a typical kind of response, it seems, from Richard Bacon MP. If Brexit results in Scotland leaving the Union, it's a price worth paying. So where is the unionist in this man?
Well, absolutely. It's not in the job description anymore. The Conservative and Unionist Party, to my knowledge, has never had that name formally in England, but it's been in an association with its Scottish sister party, which still is called the Conservative and Unionist. And very tellingly, the Conservative and Unionist Party in Northern Ireland, well, of course, it was the Ulster Unionist Party, it wouldn't contest in Northern Ireland's elections until recently, and now they've done so. So if there is a Conservative Party alongside the Unionists in Northern Ireland, that implies that they are no longer Conservative and Unionist in their policy UK-wide. And here we have the South Norfolk MP, not as in the illustration speaking from the backbenches on this occasion, but speaking at some other piddling Liberal...
Theo, that's the wrong... Yeah, thank you. Go ahead.
Richard Bacon, he was speaking actually in Edinburgh at some salon, some kind of small nations festival. And then someone, a journalist with The National, a very nationalist anti-UK paper in Edinburgh, tweeted out that he was saying this. Whether he was there as a devil's advocate or to be baited, I don't know. But we do now have one of these Shire MPs in England who is very much on the Liam Fox so-called right wing and patriotic wing of the party, a neocon basically, saying, well, let's ditch Scotland to get out of the EU. And he knows that we're not going to get Brexit anyway. So he's basically saying, let's break up the UK as an order of first priority.
And that objective fits absolutely with the creation of the city-states. You want the historic union broken apart as you bring in the city-states, the regions and the city-states. And if I may, just to add, of course, we've seen the immense power of the European Union with buying and bribing people in power in UK via all of the grant money that's come through. So even with Brexit, a possibility, we've still got, for example, Cornwall keeping their European office open. We've got the NHS still running a European office. So all those European tentacles are going to be very difficult to cut off unless there's an actual order that they are to be cut, I think.
Yes, absolutely. And we saw it there with that Politico.eu piece, letting the cat out of the bag, the EU powers, most of which are not lawful powers under common law anyway, but the EU or the institutions had them. These are being given under the radar or under the level of Westminster to the regions and nations where they're not even lawful powers for our national parliament. Our own parliament, as the Declaration of Arbroath said in Scotland and Magna Carta in England, is a parliament of the sovereign people, not a sovereign parliament, but a parliament of the sovereign people. And so many of these powers, which were in the European Union and its organs, were not lawful anyway, and besides, it's very explicit in the setting up statutes in 1998-99 for the Scottish, Welsh and Northern Irish Assemblies and the London Assembly that they only exist by virtue of having devolved powers from Westminster. So any other kinds of powers, even if they're now claimed to exist in the nations and regions in the Assemblies, they're not lawful powers.
OK, well, let's move on to TTIP. We saw a quick flash of this one a second ago, but certainly more and more people suggesting that TTIP is dead in the water. Alex, what are your comments on this?
Well, if you freeze the screen and read that, you will see the story of how a German representative of the middle class, which is, you know, the strong trading backbone of Germany, Mr. Boda, how he basically got the German population to decimate, to cut its support for TTIP, the trade deal with the US and other nations, from 55% to 17% within a couple of years. And the key moment was when another campaigner with 500,000 signatures on a petition against TTIP shouted from the back of a hall to the then Trade Commissioner of the EU, Karel de Gucht, the Belgian elitist. She said, I've got 500,000 signatures against TTIP. And he said, we negotiate for 500,000,000 people. And the Germans correctly realised that they were being treated like dirt under his shoe, really. So on the one hand, it is quite hopeful that people have turned, especially in Germany, against TTIP because they realise it will be a rush to the lowest common denominator and useless goods and services being funneled into Europe with no proper trading standards. But on the other hand, I think they realise that they feel prematurely that they've won the battle simply by petitioning, which isn't enough against these many-headed hydras European trade deals.
Indeed. So if we just put that one up again a second, Theo, you wanted to highlight Mr. Boda's book.
Yes.
How much did this have to do with the change in opinion?
Lots and lots. I can only look at the e-book figures as I get much of my reading done there now, but the Germans are way ahead of us. They're late adopters of Kindle, which started off in the US and UK, but Kindle's going out across the continent. And if you just look at EU figures, lots and lots of people have downloaded Die Freihandelslüge, the lie of free trade. Thilo Boda's point, obviously, is you don't get free trade if you vote for it. It's neither free nor trade. It impoverishes everyone and puts us in hock to corporations. A lot of Germans have understood that now.
And it looks like perhaps the French are beginning to understand it as well, because this is the French Minister of State for Foreign Trade, Matthias Feckel, and he is saying there's no more political support in France for TTIP negotiations. France calls for an end to these negotiations. His main complaint, actually, is American bullying, I suppose you might call it. He said the Americans give us nothing or just crumbs. This is not how negotiations are done between allies. We need a clear and definitive halt to these negotiations in order to restart on a good foundation. France is also calling for a halt to TAFTA. This is what's your view on this? It seems like an interesting development.
Yes, France and Germany, both very different economic cultures, but what they have in common, in a sense, is that they have this, what we would call, I suppose, lower middle class, backbone level of the country, of, you might call them craftsmen or artisans. That's more a sort of northern Italian idea, but throughout the continent, basically, the powerful economies are there because families own the companies, even the very, very big ones now. Obviously, the very suspicious ones that helped the Nazis, the chemical and industrial and steel giants, but also the household names in luxury goods production. They're all owned by single families, and these families do not want to be undercut by cheap tat coming in the first instance from the USA, where the politicians are even more sewn up than ours are, and ultimately from the poorer countries of the Pacific Rim straight into Europe with no tariffs. So that's obviously going to destroy these companies. And a lot of people realize that they're only one step away from the boss in the continental model. The boss is somebody whose ancestors employed their ancestors for hundreds of years. And we've lost that in the Anglo-Saxon world. So I think the Continentals have really passed the point of no return. They are not going to go for this deal. It's going to have to be extremely slyly reinvented as something else if the Americans want to push it onto us.
Indeed. But as you might expect, the corporatist financial elites are in complete denial and delusion about this. This article, why Britain should join the US-EU trade deal, and this is from a representative of Chatham House, and just as we said that they would, they're calling for Britain to stay in the TTIP process despite Brexit. Well, we wait with bated breath to see whether Brexit is ever going to happen. This demonstrates, in one sense, it doesn't make any difference if it does. So what are they saying? The depth of economic ties between the United States and the United Kingdom means that the TTIP option is likely to be welcomed favorably by both countries. The United States is Britain's most important single export market, with goods and services worth $45 billion shipped in 2015. Last year, the United States ranked third after Germany and China as a source for UK imports. With nearly $1 trillion invested in each other's economies, the United States and the United Kingdom are also each other's largest investors. Given this special economic relationship, Britain is unlikely to be at the back of the queue in any event, but TTIP option is the best path for preserving and strengthening and the relationship post-Brexit, while also realising the wider strategic benefits of a transatlantic trade agreement. And of course, as we pointed out prior to the Brexit vote happening, this statement from the British government as well aligned with what Chatham House has said here, where they made it absolutely clear that TTIP was at the centre of British trade policy.
I just have a question, a little bit of black humour, Mike, but on the previous slide there, I just wondered whether you could tell us, were they holding hands or not?
I think they quite possibly were, yes. That's Merkel and Theresa.
There's a lot of latent, are they or aren't they? And I believe that you posted the Brexit label over the top, so you know.
They did that.
Were they holding hands?
Yes. But, of course, TTIP is only one trade deal, as the EU would love us to realise, TISA is the big daddy of the lot. This is the trade services agreement, a trade agreement currently being negotiated by 23 members of the World Trade Organization, including the EU. Together, the participating countries account for 70% of world trade in services. And of course, services becoming increasingly important as manufacturing gets shut down. Central part of the economy of every EU country. Which countries are involved in this? Australia, Canada, Chile, Chinese Taipei, Colombia, Costa Rica, the EU, Hong Kong, Iceland, Israel, Japan, Korea, Liechtenstein, Mauritius, Mexico, New Zealand, Norway, Pakistan, Panama, Peru, Switzerland, Turkey, United States, and so it goes on. Now, interestingly enough, WikiLeaks in May released new documents on TISA, and they were showing that state-owned enterprises are going to be required to operate as if they're corporate bodies. So this is effectively a corporatization of public services. TISA also includes mechanisms for corporations to sue local governments over whatever local legislation there might be that restrict their profit making. So we've got to keep an eye on all three of these legs of the stool. Alex, thoughts?
Just one there. When you were talking about the newspaper news report there that mentioned the old canard about the UK is the biggest investor in the US and the US is the biggest investor in the UK, that does not exactly mean that Mr. Dyson and Mr. Sinclair are opening production factory facilities in Tennessee and Texas, does it? It means that Wall Street sends lots of money to the city and the city sends lots of money to Wall Street.
And, of course, it's all funny money.
Yes, yes, it's not gold.
No.
Okay, well, while people have maybe not been watching what's been happening in the areas that Mike and Alex have just covered, let's come on to where many of the public focus. So what's happening on the streets and what's happening with the police? And a very interesting article here from the BBC, Lift Police Visible Tattoo Ban, says the Police Federation. Well, this is some of it. At the moment, police presently control visible tattoos. I say apparently because we, of course, have seen a number of Devon and Cornwall police with visible tattoos. But Warren Davis MP, who was spent 30 years as a constable himself, said the whole point of having a uniform is it's a distinctive set of clothing. If you start adding to it with tattoos on arms or particularly on the hand or neck where people can see the ex-wife or the husband's details, then some people might find that offensive. And this is the Police Federation. We are calling for a modern, consistent national approach to tattoos to be adopted across the police service. The Federation believes that if the police service truly want to embrace diversity and widen the talent pool it recruits from, then forces need to be more open-minded. So communities have a police service that reflects today's society. So now we get into the heart of what's going on here. Basically, the police performance, the look of the police, has got to be dropped to the existing falling levels in society. We're not going to get the right people unless they're covered in tattoos. So this is dangerous stuff being pushed here. And of course, the BBC is very happy to do that. Well, this is the lady from the Police Federation, Chief Inspector Victoria Martin, and she thinks there should be a sensible conversation about tattoos. This is in reality that the police should be allowed to more or less have the tattoos that they want to. So if we go to her Twitter page, interesting angel of the north there. But what do we find? Well, the first thing here is a mixture between gay pride and tattoos, with this police constable saying that basically her arm is, you know, quite acceptable. So this is not about a few tattoos. This is about the police being able to change itself to reflect the lowest possible denominator for society. So where does it head? Well, we can show you quite easily because we just bring in what's going on with the American police at the moment. And in Chicago, we've got the police union fighting orders banning visible tattoos. And this gives you an example of where we can head pretty quickly. I'm going to say without any trouble at all, I believe it's wrong. I believe it's offensive. And particularly where there's heavy tattoos on the face, people can find this
thuggish
and intimidating. So this is further demeaning Britain's police force. But the aim is drop things to the lowest standard.
Alex, you wanted to say something?
Yes, two things. One is Steve, one of our viewers right there in Plymouth, has said in the chat box, this is to get us used to the blurring between supposedly public police and private police so that the two look identical as they increasingly are. And the other is that the Chief Constable of Gloucestershire has set a national precedent. She herself, by the way, is very proudly of a certain inclination. She has decreed that all policemen with beards must either shave them off or wear sanitary beard nets while on duty. In order to ridicule their beardedness, basically, and get them to shave it off. So beards are too patriarchal, apparently, and her excuse is hygienic, but we can have tattooed thugs.
Okay. Well, we'll follow along with this theme because we're picking up on it nicely. Let's have a look at trouble at Notting Hill Carnival here. So the Mail, just one paper that's got a lot of coverage. I found this quite interesting. The police had seized a taser, really dangerous weapon, which is why they carry them all. But anybody else has got a taser, obviously got to be taken away from them. So 450 arrested, 43 officers injured, and there's a stabbing as well. But what I wanted to do is draw people's attention to the uniforms being worn. So here's one set of police officers. And OK, they've got the yellow high visibility jackets on, but it's interesting to see that they've got traditional uniforms, including white shirts and helmets. But we've also got these people that are apparently also police. So you can see many photographs with these baseball hatted individuals in some sort of blue uniform. These are more traditional police, and I think that this is actually quite encouraging. Do they look smart? Yes. Do they look threatening? Not particularly, because they are men and women in a uniform, but they look smart and they've got those white shirts on. But of course, here we go with dropping police standards, because the papers have made very big on police who are engaged with women in twerking. And what are we talking about? We're talking about simulated sex in public. So get those tattoos in, get the police dropping to the lowest denominator in society, get them debasing themselves on the streets. And then, of course, we're even further down the path of being out of control with our own police force. But as you've hinted, Alex, there's more to come. And thank you very much for the viewer who picked up this from the Nottingham Post. That the Nottinghamshire Police are encouraging members of the public to come along on their stop and search operations in order to get a feel for how it's done and that it's totally transparent. I think what's happening here is the public are being trained to accept stop and search, but they also have to sign a non-disclosure agreement. So we're actually recruiting snitches at the same time. So you can see this policy coming through, the police being integrated in society. And my mind always comes back on the Eastern Bloc countries, where, of course, at the height of communism, nobody was too sure who was friend and who was foe, because anybody could be a member of the government spying, including your own family. And then here's the final bit of what? Globalist agenda for the police. So thank you also to the viewer who provided this one, the Globe and Mail. It's talking about Norfolk. A retired Canadian diplomat becomes a police commissioner in England. And I thought you might think about Mr. Mark Carnage, Mike, as you saw this one. But let's bring in the key statement. Last year, the local Conservative Party Association asked him to run for PCC. He agreed, but worried that his Canadian accent might be an issue. But it's all turned out OK. So now we can actually see that what we've got is the Tory party starting a global system. You are policing for the Tory party, but you can come from anywhere in the world. And I find this deeply sinister. Alex, I'm interested to know what you think on this one.
Well, I agree that you have to be a citizen, Her Majesty's subject, to be old-fashioned about it. And, OK, to come from another crown possession is an advantage, but you still have to swear or affirm your loyalty to Her Majesty and to the laws of Britain. And I would say also revoke your other citizenship. There's also the question of whether the Canadian so-called human rights culture, which is one of the world's worst, together with Sweden, would infect his attitude towards the police, which it would. And thirdly, I'm sorry to say that there is yet another sexual depravity link. I noticed in that quotation you put up there that he said he was worried whether his Canadian accent would make him seen as someone who was not normal for Norfolk. Now, as usual with these phrases, like when people say common purpose, it might be just a turn of phrase, but I know from East Anglian contacts that normal for Norfolk, or the acronym NFN, is well known in police and social work services in East Anglia as a way of writing off incest within families as nothing to be particularly concerned about. So I'm sorry to say that yet again there is a sign of the police embracing sexual depravity.
Well, thank you for that, Alex. Okay. Let's just move on through.
Okay, Alex. Yes, sorry. Change agents. Now, if anybody in any UK column members have not yet read the Towards a Million Change Agents article on the UK column website, it's on the front page at the moment, towards the bottom. Please read it and distribute it, because this is explaining what's going on in the National Health Service in a way that many other organisations aren't presenting it, and they don't quite understand it. But Alex, here we've got an article from the Netherlands, which is showing that at least somebody understands that the same process is going on there.
Yes, this is an interesting one from De Correspondent, which is a kind of social democratic associate of young journalists, quite independent-minded and open to other philosophies. And the title here is translates as "Why the boss of Buurtzorg," which means neighbourhood care, a company name, "why the boss of neighbourhood care should be the boss of the Netherlands." And he outlines, I've put a Facebook post out about this and tweeted a link to the Facebook post, which is longer than you can say in a tweet. He's describing how this boss of the organisation Neighbourhood Care, or Buurtzorg, basically broke all the rules which the Dutch had imported from Britain and America about modern healthcare. He doesn't want any managers, he doesn't want timesheets or codes, he doesn't want cost centres, he doesn't want a call centre. He says, "My job as a manager is not to go on management courses, but to let people do their jobs." He says, "I am expressly not influenced by Steve Jobs, because his book is a load of bunk. I never go on training courses to be a change agent or a disruptor, because that way we'll just get a self-reinforcing clique who think they're at the cutting edge and don't know anything." So very sensible stuff. And what was the Dutch establishment's reaction there? Because, as it points out in the article, no job title has grown more quickly in number in the last two decades in the whole of this country, the Netherlands, than the job title of healthcare manager, which is a frightening prospect to me, because they're not healthcare professionals, they're healthcare managers. It's an interesting attitude, because he specifically says we don't want change agents and we don't want disruptors and we don't want people who've been trained to think of themselves as that. Because as Brian has been pointing out, and also Martin Edwards and others in their article series, but I think of Brian when he was visiting the people on the picket line at Derriford Hospital in Plymouth a few months ago, and that was on the broadcast, he was saying to the NHS frontline staff, as we're supposed to call them these days, the real carers, "Do you know that there are disruptors and change agents? Here are their documents." And the doctors, and the junior doctors particularly, were saying, "What on earth is this? This sounds very sinister indeed." So we have a senior guy in the Netherlands who stood up to this. And what was the Dutch establishment's reaction? Well, the kind of care that you offer has to be timesheeted by your company and go into a national system, regardless of which company you're for. And there were hundreds and hundreds of these codes. And he said, "I'm not going to do anything about that." So when his company started, they started a new code. I think it was R002, neighborhood care, just for his company, so that they could still go into the timesheets and the cost codes.
Okay. Well, of course, this is the change agents. This is the common purpose at work. And you have an article here from Radio Free Europe. Finland in common purpose with NATO?
Well, Finland was very, very delicately poised between NATO and the Soviet Union for decades, and then with post-independence Russia, and was, together with Sweden and Austria, was constitutionally not engaged in, not able to engage in NATO or the EEC or now the EU. And that was all changed in the 90s with the EU. But they still are not in NATO. What's happened now, according to Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, which is a US and European neocon establishment, is that they're saying that they're going to have, or they have had, government-level dinners with NATO for the first time. Now, that's just a nicety. For the Russians, it's all the same as saying Finland is a de facto member of NATO, which massively increases the length of a Russian direct border that flanks NATO and is not going to be taken lying down by the Russians. And interestingly enough, in the middle of the article, again, it's the RFERL journalist, not NATO itself, but it's telling. The journalist says the Finnish government dined with NATO this summer for the first time ever in a show of common purpose.
So what I wasn't clear about when I looked at this was where that language came from. At the bottom of the article, it says information originally sourced from Reuters, but of course they didn't link back to the original source information, and because it didn't have a title to search for, I didn't get the chance to look in any great detail for it. So I'm not sure whether that turn of phrase was coming from Radio Free Europe or whether it was coming from Reuters or whether it was coming from a press release from Finland or NATO. So it might be interesting to do a little bit more work on that and find out exactly who was saying that and where that came from.
Yes, my experience is with groups like RFERL is that they have very few native speakers of English doing the journalism. And what's telling is other people might have other feelings, but my feeling as a professional translator is common purpose is not a particularly widespread phrase in English. It's an old common law term, to be at common purpose, and Brian Orr often points that out. But other than that, it's not something that's on people's lips. It's not a buzzword, and for it to turn up so often implies that a few people are in the know and are recycling this phrase.
Yes. Okay, well, let's move on. The theme of the next couple of slides is it's the 1930s again in Munich, and you wanted to highlight this YouTube video where a British interviewer is going around speaking to people in Munich with the question, what do you think of Angela Merkel? You were quite taken with the looks on their faces, the responses that they were, nervous to be speaking?
Yes, I mean, even within Germany, the Bavarians are outspoken. Anywhere in Germany, in the days I used to go there a lot, the 80s, the 90s, people would very happily chat with you. Whether you had a camera or not, say, if you said, I'm a British visitor, what do you think of this country? They would tell you a lot. The Bavarians are particularly proud, independent, have a very strong localist and Catholic heritage, and they're not supposed to be afraid of anyone, not even Berlin. But all of a sudden, you go out on the streets, and this guy, in a very charming, affected British accent, asks people in German, was halten Sie für Angela Merkel, which isn't even proper German, but what do you think of Angela Merkel? And people are like pushing the camera away like this. And some of them, like the younger student types, giggle and say, I can't really say. You know, it's Stasi stuff.
Interesting. And then we've got this one in the Telegraph here. Germans told to stockpile food and water in civil defense plans. So again, memories of the pre-war time.
Yes, the Germans and the Swiss, but for different reasons, mistrust banking and digital money. And although here in the Netherlands and in other countries that border Germany, like Denmark, it's effectively impossible to pay for anything serious in cash now. Government offices won't take it. The French banks will report you if you try to take out more than 1,000 euros, and the Italians. In Germany, you can withdraw 10 grand just like that to buy a second-hand car and whack it down in big bundles. That's because the Germans remember the hyperinflation of the Weimar Republic. And in the Swiss case, the Swiss looked at their neighbours and said, we are not going to repeat that mistake. So housewives in Switzerland will pay with 1,000-franc notes, which is basically £1,000 more or less, for their groceries and take 950 in change. So the Germans obviously are very worried about what's going to happen now with the free migration into Germany. And the government has been very authoritarian in the past in telling people there is nothing to worry about, trust your authorities. And all of a sudden, I think the German government's realised that it will not be able to control the situation and is saying it would be good for you to have a cellar with a week's worth of food in it. Big change.
Wow. Okay. Well, speaking of banks and the financial crisis, of course, we all know it's coming. But more rhetoric in the press warning us of that fact. This is CNBC saying banks are preparing for an economic nuclear winter. European banks in particular, they say, have had a very tough 6 months. And the shock and volatility around Brexit, here we go again, we're blaming Brexit for it, has sent banking stocks south. Nothing to do with the fact that the banks are basically insolvent. That has nothing to do with the stock price, of course. Major European banks, they say, like Deutsche Bank and Credit Suisse, saw their shares free fall after the referendum result, and so on. The current uncertainty over the UK will start the process of quitting the EU, has banks on tenterhooks, but a source told CNBC that the banks are preparing for an economic nuclear winter situation. We discussed this a little bit last week, Alex, and we didn't really get a chance to discuss it with you. The fact that the European Central Bank is effectively playing with monetary policy in a way that we haven't seen ever before. And in fact, some reports saying that the European Central Bank is basically threatening national governments to impose certain types of economic policies that perhaps otherwise they wouldn't be implementing, with the threat from the ECB that they'll be even more extreme with their future economic policies if those their wishes aren't complied with. This is a pretty dangerous situation we're in, and people are playing with fire.
We're very much playing with fire. The European continentals are very hacked off with what the ECB is doing. It's easy to forget in Britain, where we still have nominal sovereignty over our money supply and our minting, although we know that's all haywire. It's easy to forget how powerless the continentals are, particularly the wealthier, more organised nations like the Netherlands here, or Germany, or Austria, or Finland. They cannot do anything. They don't. I mean, I know Germany exerts huge pressure on the ECB de facto, but officially, the Mediterranean countries that are as broke can be have got as much of a say on interest rates. And of course, if you raise even by 0.25%, a lot of people are going to default on their houses in Italy, which is going to be a huge domino if it goes. Not to mention Portugal, Greece, and Ireland, which are total basket cases now. So there's a great deal of worry. I see with being an account holder with both a Dutch and a British bank that the messages you get from the bank about interest rates being cut again are very different. The Dutch ones are very matter of fact, sort of don't bother contacting us about this. It's gone down again. The NatWest ones are much more sort of, we're terribly sorry, we can't do anything about it, even though Britain is not in the Eurozone or under the ECB, but it's all feeding through. You can see that the continentals are being very tight-lipped about it. And the pensioners are outraged here on the continent because their savings have been wiped out.
There we go.
Okay, well,
let's move on.
To finish off on the lie, of course, that there's no money, but what have we covered just in the last few minutes? We've got Germany's 1930s, we've got Germany stockpiling food, we've got the banks looking at a nuclear winter. What has the Conservative government been doing? Utterly destroying Britain's military and the ability of the country to protect itself. And this is the most incredible article by the Daily Mail, all about HMS Ocean going out to take over the NATO operation against ISIS, leading the fight back. British warship HMS Ocean will take charge of coalition naval operations in the Gulf against ISIS militants. So we are to believe, Mike, that this amazing group of terrorists are just so powerful that we've got half the American fleet ranged against them. And Ocean, our capital ship, is being sent out. Well, let's bring in Mr. Fallon, because he's full of nonsense. We've got a Type 45 HMS Daring is going to go as well. Mr. Fallon said the decision to use HMS Daring in the operation could make a real difference around the world. So we've got one ship, which is okay, apparently, if the water is not too warm, Mike, is going to make a real difference around the world. This man is believing his own rhetoric. These are very dangerous people. They're playing games in a dangerous world situation. And let's remember, of course, that HMS Ocean is due to be scrapped. So having spent $65 million on it, money we don't have, apparently, we're now going to scrap the ship early. And what is it? It's a helicopter ship. It's basically designed to put troops ashore. this is not a capital ship. This is a support ship, effectively, and anywhere it goes, it needs to be defended. And if we can contrast what's going on, we are led to believe that HMS Ocean is carrying out this amazing role. And the implication from the Daily Mail is that it's taking over from something like this, the USS Truman, 90 aircraft. This is complete and utter nonsense being pushed. And, of course, we've got lies on the nation that the Royal Navy's being cut significantly, but the Conservatives don't want to talk about it. But where did the Daily Mail get this story cobbled together? Well, it appears it's this gentleman, Abe Hawkin. And if you look into his background of a couple of years, he's a sports reporter. So presumably we're going to see ISIS competing in the next Olympics, I would think, Mike, if this man is to be followed. So there we are. There's the headline, leading the fight back. And Ocean is going to be in charge of the coalition naval operations against ISIS. I don't think so. It will take over from a US aircraft carrier. No, it won't. And the commanding officer will give battle orders. This is out of Swallows and Amazons, I think, Mike. Alex, is it me, or are we now living in Disney cartoon politics?
Well, call me prejudiced, but the chap does not exactly look like a man who understands the military, does he? And I'm aware of there being such a thing as an order of battle, which is a comprehensive tree describing the whole of a nation's armed forces. But battle orders, no, lost me there.
So let's just say it. Could we? Is it going to be scrapped in the Gulf? A USS Liberty style incident, perhaps?
What, let it sink and then claim that ISIS did it?
ISIS did it,
well,
yeah.
I think they're capable of trying anything, but for us to believe that this group of individuals are so powerful that with mobile telephones they can take on America, they can take on NATO, is absolutely laughable with black humour. Alex, I think we're at the end today. Thank you very much for joining us. I believe you wanted to say a few words to close.
Yes, we might be interrupted by the mantelpiece clock striking 3, which is the time over here in Holland. But just to say, my wife is in a poorly way, and so I'm going to be taking a few weeks out to accompany her through treatment. So I won't be around until, God willing, the end of October. I should be able to join you again. I'll be carrying on with the Doherty investigation in some kind of coordinating role. I'm enjoying the fact that I'm difficult to get at, because David Scott went on Open Your Mind Radio in Ireland yesterday and said those of us who don't have children, in my case, or in his case, don't have small children anymore, and in my case also living in a different country, we're able to speak on behalf of the Dohertys and many others. So I'm enjoying being slightly out of reach. I'm not invulnerable, but we're going to carry on, and we're going to be turning up the volume. A small indication of what happened with the Dohertys: I emailed a well-connected Irish clergyman, let's put it at that, who I had interpreted for here in Benelux a couple of years ago, about the case, and I got nothing back. And all of a sudden, having sent him a second email about it this morning, later this morning I got an attempted Skype call by a Belgian clergyman from the same order, who had not talked to me for a long time, who had been at the same conference. And when I called him back on his Belgian mobile, deliberately, not on Skype, he took fright and said, Alexander, I pressed the wrong button. I called you by mistake. Now, these men have not been in touch with me for 2 years, so I suspect very much that the Catholic grapevine has been putting it out that some of this knowledge is spreading. And I can't think of any other reason why that Belgian monk would have contacted me. And there was definite fear in his voice, because, of course, I was calling him on his Belgian mobile, not on Skype, and it would be easier for him to be listened in on, which to me implies the international nature of what's going on with the Dohertys.
Well, you couldn't have put that better. For them, the bell tolls, I think, but we'll see how it develops. Alex, thank you very much for joining us. That's it for today's news. I've got to say, I will be away for a few days, and Mike will be here running the show. So join us.
1 o'clock tomorrow.
Thanks very much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.